This is an OTM podcast extra. Bob Garfield sits down with Bob Mankoff, The New Yorker's cartoon editor. I must warn you, though, the F word is used.
This is Bob Mankoff's time. The cartoon editor of The New Yorker has just published a memoir, How About Never Is Never Good For You. He's a regular on WNYC's The New Yorker Radio Hour, and last week he was featured in the HBO documentary Very Semi-Serious. The man known for his own stippled drawing style and deadpan gags is suddenly everywhere. Well, count me in. A few weeks back, I sat down with Mankoff at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington to discuss his career and the art of the cartoon. Now, the live audience had the benefit of Mankoff's PowerPoint presentation and saw things you will hear referred to, but we're confident you can fill in the blanks. Meantime, we began, of all places, not with what New Yorker cartoons are, but what they are not, namely, off-color, because this is not the Comedy Cellar, this is The New Yorker.
I mean, it's interesting. Sometimes I look at it as The New Yorker cartoons ask you to tie one hand behind your back and sometimes both hands. Because when you really look how people are funny in the most belly laugh way, it's not through great ideas. If you look up stand-up comedians, it's going to be transgressive, saying things you shouldn't say. And that's an enormous skill to do stand-up. But if you take someone who's like Sarah Silverman, who's gifted, it's going to be very hard for you to remember any of her ideas. It's some idea, but what you're going to remember is, I can't believe she said that. And so since The New Yorker removes the transgressive nature, the obscene nature, the aggressive nature, even for the most part, the offensive nature, it's got to be the idea or else there's nothing left. I think it shifted somewhat under Tina, you know, because she was more edgy. She wanted more like that.
You're talking about Tina Brown when Tina Brown had a 4 or 5 year tenure as editor of the magazine.
Yeah, she really shook it up. William Shawn took over from Harold Ross. And William Shawn was like, even though he was actually a Jewish guy, I think his father's name is John, he was a Mandarin. I mean, I maybe actually saw William Shawn in all the years I was there once or twice. He had a separate elevator. He had all sorts of quirks. No snakes could be in cartoons. It was a great magazine. I remember when I was first attracted to the New Yorker magazine, the cartoons interested me, but I was at Syracuse and I was a sports fan, a basketball fan, and there was an article by John McPhee about Bill Bradley called A Sense of Where You Are. And it went on 65 pages. And you were just in this world. It was the writing world, and that was the world of William.
I remember that piece. It read like it was 59.
So it changed, and then the new houses bought it, and they felt they had to spruce it up, and they brought in Bob Gottlieb, and then Tina shook everything, really shook everything up. And during Tina's reign, you would have cartoons like a guy has just had a proctology exam, and he says to the doctor, "Does this make me your bitch?" And so probably we won't do that again.
So we discussed ideas, including off-color ones. Now let's get to the drawings part. Some people can draw.
Yes.
Some people can't draw. And it seems to me some people who can't draw can draw cartoons. James Thurber.
Right.
Roz Chast. And someone else I can think of. And some people who can draw absolutely can't do a cartoon to save their lives.
I agree with what you're saying, and I would put it this way. There's bad drawing, and there's good bad drawing. There's good drawing, and there's bad good drawing. Just like singing. I mean, does Bob Dylan have a good voice? No, he doesn't. But he's got the right voice for what he's singing. You know what I mean? To the degree to which the drawing is sort of loose, like Thurber, or even like Roz, who actually draws quite well, it's like the way your handwriting expresses your personality. Look at it this way. A completely realistic drawing, an absolutely accurate drawing, can't express your personality at all. There's different types of drawing that's appropriate for different jokes. For instance, let's say there's a cartoon like this. There's a gallows, okay? and there's steps that go up, but there's also a ramp for the handicap. The more realistically that would be drawing, the more unfunny it would be.
There's a number of genres and subgenres and tropes that familiar over the decades of the New Yorker. You got your desert island. You got your St. Peter's Gate. You got your mountaintop man of enlightenment. There's a whole mess of them. But if there's one thing that I most associate with the New Yorker in the 50 years that I've been looking at it, it's the ones that are poking fun at the sensibilities of, you know, the Upper East Side, wealthy and sophisticated. William Hamilton, in particular. These dense portraits of blue bloods, dense to the concerns of the hoi polloi. It's satire, but I can't remember ever actually laughing. And now you have Bruce Eric Kaplan, who you wrote about in your book. He signs B-E-K. He seems to mine a lot of the same material. But I wonder if that business of satirizing the stereotypical New Yorker reader is a bit of a relic.
No.
All right, next question.
Let me put your mind at ease. Rich people are people, too. And they're not really. I mean, it's a very wide demographic. I think it's interesting because what the New Yorker is making fun of is its own readership. And I think that's where the cartoons are, for the most part, self-reflective. The stock and trade of humor is making fun of the other, and usually down. Editorial, supposedly poke up. The New Yorker is pretty much self-reflexive. So a William Hamilton cartoon where there's a couple leaving a party and they're talking to the host and the woman is saying, "Oh yes, we know them, we hate them." It's wonderful. It tells you really how people react. You know, a Bruce Eric Kaplan cartoon. Bruce Eric Kaplan is a little bit like Charles Adams. It's a completely inverted world of sensibility. So it's two mothers and they're watching their kids and other kids in strollers. And one is saying to the other, "They grow up so slow." First of all, that is such a perfect joke because it's just one word. Now, Bruce was a writer for Seinfeld. Now I think he's the producer of Girls, and he wrote, you know, for Six Feet Under. So a number of the cartoonists have other jobs. And it tends to be a certain note, but I think he hits that note. And then Roz is her own territory, and everybody does their thing.
Let's clarify this without talking specific numbers. You're probably the only person who can make a living entirely in the world of New Yorker cartoons.
You used to have a better chance of making a living as a New Yorker cartoonist because it just wouldn't be the cartoons that appeared. You get advertising gigs, but you're absolutely right. It's difficult. In the movie, very semi-serious, Eric Kaplan, Bruce talks about it. He says, look, if you're involved in a creative enterprise, you understand it may not completely work out financially for you. You may have to do other things. I think more than ever, that's what this whole gig economy is, isn't it? For a long time, people say, well, there's not enough women cartoonists. In fact, if you'll see this film, you'll see that the whole women's comedy thing is coming like a locomotive, and there's not enough minority cartoonists. Well, one of the problems is we're talking about a fairly unremunerative field that it's very hard to break into. So that said, Emily Flake, who you saw on there, is teaching a course at SVA, School of Visual Arts. I want to try to get a minority scholarship. I mean, we have to have an outreach, but the problem is a very deep one in society in terms of diversity, that it goes to education, it goes to economics, you know, to the time when it gets, okay, now I have the luxury of submitting cartoons to the New Yorker. Truthfully, okay, what was my luxury in a way? Okay, I quit graduate school, and my parents, I have the thing that my parents, you know, faint and whatever. But then my father, who had carpet and linoleum stores, gives me $200 a month. He says, take a shot. Well, you actually need some support. So it's a long-term project, but we really are trying.
I want to talk to you about process. We saw a glimpse in the book of what you do in selecting cartoons during the course of the week.
I
want to begin more towards the end of the week when you're sitting there and you've got a number of candidates that you're giving to David Remnick.
Yeah.
And he's the editor of The New Yorker, and he makes the final call.
Right.
You must have favorites. And sometimes he'd say, nope, Have you ever been, let's say, near a fist fight?
I say to him, David, you may not regret this today. You may not regret this tomorrow. But you will regret rejecting this cartoon for the rest of your life.
And once it's rejected, is it gone forever? Can they ever be resurrected?
No, I always put him back. First of all, David's a great guy. He's a funny guy. There's nothing infallible about this process. Humor is incredibly subjective. I, frankly, have a philosophy. I want a range. I want to play. I want observational. I want crazy. I want to push the idea of a cartoon and stuff. And so I will show the stuff to David. And actually, I'm sort of grateful after the whole week of sort of sifting and sifting, you're getting to sort of a normal human being. And it's not just David. It would be Sylvia Killingsworth and now Kelly Stout. David has brought other people into it, especially younger women into it, sort of to get their take. It's basically a sort of a fun process where I think it's a sort of respite for David after looking at, you know, these 10,000-word articles and stuff. And sometimes I think he's hard for him to shift gears because he's been in this very cognitively intense, logical mode, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, he's seeing a cartoon and the caption is something like, either those ducks are dead or we're upside down at the bottom of a lake.
There is a 60 Minutes piece about you.
Yeah.
And it shows these Tuesday afternoon visits by would-be New Yorker cartoonists who stand there or sit there across from your desk as you look at their submissions. To watch you sit there and talk to all these people, and almost all of them you're going to send away disappointed. You clearly are not a man without empathy. How do you keep them and yourself from not slashing your wrists?
Well, look, humor can be used for good or evil. I've chosen evil. I'm actually very nice to these people. I mean, New York Jewish nice, which is like for the Midwest is an asshole. But I'm just saying, marked on a curve from where I come from, I'm nice. Well, first of all, I'm opening it up. Anybody can see me. You tell me other places in New York which have this thing with rent where anybody can make an appointment and come and see me. In the movie, you'll see this Liana Fink, these new cartoonists come in, and she's very sensitive. And so I do actually try to use my psychology background to say, what does this person need? Because I really want them to be a cartoonist. I don't want them not to be a cartoonist. That's actually my greatest satisfaction. So you'll see in that movie, there's this guy, Ed Steed. He's 25. He lives in Taipei. He's about 6'2". He's 125 pounds. He's from England. He was a sheep herder. Okay, he lives in Taipei because it's cheap. He could cartoon. And in the movie, so he's English. So they ask, well, you know, why'd you become a New York cartoonist? He said, I was traveling in Vietnam, and I saw it online, and I said, oh, I could do this, and he could. And so even though he looks meek and everything, he's absolutely confident. Liana Fink, who's in the magazine, on the other hand, was so doubtful of everything. And so that's a person you have to encourage. So here's something also that happens. Someone who's older comes in. They've retired. They're 55, 60. They've always wanted to do cartoons. And you know what? They're actually sort of funny and they're not too bad. And I tell them, you don't want to do this. You don't have the energy for it. You're not going to have the determination. You're not going to be there every week. You're not going to rack your brains Monday night to make the deadline and stay up late and do it. It's not a young person's game if you've been acculturated to it, but it's definitely a young person's game to get into. So I'll be blunt in that way, but I actually think that's being nice because not so they don't waste their time.
And do you ever say, please, why are you here?
Only to Norman Mailer. So Norman.
Okay, hold it.
Yes.
I was going to save this for later, okay. But in your book, you drop the names of a number of people who aspired to be New Yorker cartoonists, and they weren't anonymous. They were Norman Mailer. They were Roger Ebert. And as you were so indiscreet in the book as to list their names, could you do it again for us?
Yeah, now? Well, okay. So when I became cartoon editor, David Mamet, the playwright, sent me a bunch of cartoons. He said, congratulations on becoming cartoon editor. I've taken the liberty of sending you a batch of cartoons. And I sent him back a note saying, thank you very much. I've taken the liberty of sending you a play.
Do you have to deal with suspicions from other cartoonists that, you know, the deck is stacked in your favor when it comes time to evaluate a Mankoff panel?
Well, look, that's a hard-hitting question. And don't think I haven't thought about it. The conflict of interest, especially that's involved in me selecting the cartoons, drawing the cartoons, and licensing the cartoons. So I've established a Blue Ribbon Committee to look at this.
These things consisting of?
These things, me. Actually, I do very few cartoons now. I did feel there was a conflict. It's only when I have like a particular idea that I sort of think is good. And then David will feel perfectly fine to reject it. The other thing is, so I went from being a cartoonist, a player, to sort of a player coach. When I took over in 1997, there was still this competitive thing. I want my ideas, but I'm cartoon editor. How do I handle that? But as this whole new generation of kids came in, honestly, you would be blown away by the amount of creativity that comes in. And the other thing is that over time, I just got much more interested in editing the stuff, mentoring the stuff, just using actually something that you gain from being older by seeing all this material. So this whole complex of, this is the way this joke could be made better. I mean, it sounds weird, but it's often the case that when your talent is at its highest tide, you are a terrible editor. You can't look at it. It's just like coming out of you. But actually, as that particular talent ebbs and you try to remember how you do it, you're better actually at guiding people, different muscles.
This is going to be the most difficult part of the conversation because we are now going to discuss individual cartoons.
Okay, go ahead.
In reading your book, I laughed really hard at a number of panels, including your own. The one from you that made me laugh so hard, it was an IRS auditor sitting with the auditee, and they were going over his tax forms, and the auditor says, now this over here, this is where you're going to have to go to jail.
It's all deadpan. You added a little glee to it. And if you look at it, there's no expression like that. He's just saying, now this over here, this is why you're going to have to go to jail. And it's better like that. And that's what I tell the cartoonists, because a lot of young cartoonists that come in, the people are mugging. They're not letting the joke do the work, sort of the subtle thing. And really, that's the whole point of that cartoon, that it's a tiny little thing why he's going to have to go to jail. But it can be a tiny little thing. And there's great IRS cartoons from the New Yorker. One of them, probably from the 40s or 50s, the IRS guy. And this is a little stereotypical one because the person being audited is a woman. And he's saying to her, let's go over this one honest mistake at a time.
All right. Now, another not by you was the Lassie cartoon.
Oh, yeah.
Which is simple perfection. Would you kindly describe it, since obviously I'm going to do a shabby job of it?
No. Timmy is in distress, and he's, I don't know if he's drowning or something. He says, Lassie, get help. And next thing you see is Lassie at the psychiatrist's couch. And that's by Danny Shanahan.
Did you laugh hard? Do you ever laugh hard?
I never laugh hard at cartoons. It's weird because, I mean, I'm looking at cartoons, and generally my feeling is this is great.
You were talking about the brief flirtation with vulgarity under Tina Brown.
Yeah.
And after Tina, I think under David, you did a cartoon that I think is hilarious. And it's five or six mafiosi. And, well, tell me what the...
Okay, so it's done when the Sopranos came out. Mafioso guys are all sitting around. There's the head guy in the room saying, these walls could talk, and they knew what was good for them, they'd shut the fuck up. But we never published that cartoon.
It's a shame.
Because we don't use fuck in the New Yorker. That's all.
Yeah.
I guess I'm okay with that. It seems very antiquated and stuff, and yet it's sort of the tone of it. Of course, the crazy thing is it's the idea that children will see it. I mean, for the New Yorker, we do have, okay, so it's a couple in bed, and they're reading, And the guy says to the woman, this is a cartoon of mine, the guy says, what's your opinion on some sex marriage?
There was another about performance anxiety, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, it has the guy, so it there's a woman in bed, and you see the guy in the same pose. Rodin's the thinker, and she's saying, stop thinking about it. So, yeah, so there are a lot of, I mean, in terms of the stereotypes that exist, which aren't really true, it's like the guy always wants sex, and the woman doesn't want to have sex. But the truth is that jokes are based on familiar templates, stereotypical situations. Really, all of sitcom is. So if you look at sitcom, you looked at Seinfeld, right? Look at each part. There's a predictability. We know how the people are going to behave. And so what I said in the book is people, they like novelty within a cocoon of familiarity. That's really what jokes are. So, for example, if you do an experiment where you tell a joke, you do the setup, and you stop it, you have one group of people predict the punchline, and the other group of people just experience. People like the most predictable ones. Not all people, but in general. So at The New Yorker, we don't do that exactly. We keep pushing it, making it a little bit less.
In the book, there's, I think it's from the cartoon caption contest.
Yeah.
Scene on a sofa, and there's a rooster, and he's kind of making the moves on a duck, and the duck is pulling back.
Yeah.
And I don't think it provides options to choose from. May I propose something for
yes.
you?
Yes.
Have you been tested for salmonella?
Okay, so we get 5,000 to 10,000 captions every week, so that would have been a fairly common one.
and that's all the time we have.
And bird flu. You know, I think when the one was, oh, so that's why you crossed the road.
Don McLean has a love-hate relationship with Bye Bye American Pie.
Me too.
It doesn't matter what he does
yeah.
to the day he dies. He could win the Triple Crown. He will be Don McLean of American Pie. My last question for you tonight is, what is your relationship with Is Never Good For You?
We're very tight. You know, I do say it'll be in the obituary. I know that. I don't have a love-hate relationship with it. I was surprised about it. It's a snotty line, you know. I think the thing that I like about it, when you look at it as the structure of the joke and why it works, is that the conflict is between the syntax of politeness and the message being rude. You might say, why doesn't it end with, no Thursdays out, how about never? Could end there, right? But it continues with, is never good for you, because that makes it polite. And also, it doesn't use fuck.
Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Mankoff.
Thank you.
This has been an OTM Podcast Extra. I'm Bob Garfield.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.